It is Friday, June the 1st. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, should North Korea and the U.S. meet? What impact on China?
There could be some detrimental effect to China with more of a flood of refugees or more of an open border.
U.S. Defense Chief heading for the Shangri-La dialogue in Singapore.
I think Mattis will probably use this, as he has the last couple of years, to sort of lay down some markers on growing concern about China.
Also ahead, reaction to new U.S. tariffs, plus two rap singers go after one another. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says real progress has been made in negotiations with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's top deputy in New York toward holding a potential summit between Kim and President Trump. Pompeo also has been in touch with South Korean President Moon Jae-in.
I've spoken to my counterparts there. I've spoken to President Moon. We understand their concerns. We understand the risks that can be posed to them. And an agreement that we reach will provide an outcome that each of those countries can sign on to as well.
And for some perspective on what's ahead with a Trump-Kim summit, VOA's David Byrd speaks with California State University Fullerton Korea scholar Christine Dennehy.
What do you think Kim Jong-un's main goals are for this summit?
From the consensus that I've been able to gather, the nuclear capabilities put him in a stronger position now to gain some legitimacy on the international stage, but that this emphasis now to be more conciliatory is in large part driven by a desire to have some of these economic sanctions eased and to be able to come through on some of these ideas to develop the economy a little bit more outside of just more limited trade with China and some of their more traditional trading partners.
The United States recently announced that it would pull out of what was known as the Iran nuclear deal. Does that overshadow any possible summit between the two leaders?
Not sure that it overshadows it, but I think that it definitely, you have to look at what's going on in the White House from that global perspective, that they're interrelated. And so I was just at an event recently that a couple of the commentators emphasized North Korea actually having closer relations with smaller countries like Libya and Iran and Syria, even though the presence of China and historically those ties are very close and important, but that we shouldn't overlook some of the relations that North Korea has been able to foster for some of these smaller countries as well. And one theory that was put forth also by some commentators recently is that there may have been pressure by Israel to put pressure on the Trump administration to monitor the North Korean situation and the ill effects that that would have, the kind of nuclear capabilities and North Korea's relations with countries like Iran, negative effects that would have on Israel to have Trump prioritize a denuclearization for that reason, for his strong close relations, obviously, that he has with Israel lately.
What benefit will Beijing get if the two presidents get together and the United States' goal of verifiable denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula becomes a reality?
I think in the case of China, the situation I'm more familiar with, and that if there's a deal that's made with multiple players, it seems to be that over the last several years, one of the fears that people have been pointing out about China is this flood of refugees. If the peninsula is reunified or if there are major changes that are made, that there could be some detrimental effect to China with more of a flood of refugees or more of an open border. So that, I think, is one thing, certainly, if that was monitored, if North Koreans had other options, if there were, in fact, some investments that were made by Western countries or other places, other countries into North Korea, that that might stem the flow and be something that would be beneficial for China.
President Trump is expected to meet with Prime Minister Abe before he meets with the North Korean leader if the summit comes off. What do you think that talk is going to be about?
One other factor I think that is somewhat related but seems to me to be a little bit overlooked in the American media is the push by Prime Minister Abe to revise the Constitution so that Japan can build up its military more and not be kind of hiding behind this notion of a self-defense force, which really does have more capabilities. And so it seems to be some of the comments that Trump has been making recently, not just about the cost for the American taxpayers for the military bases in Japan, but also in South Korea, and that if he can kind of offload those costs and be an ally with Abe in the same way to build up the military or have Japan bear more of those costs, that it seems to me that that could be a win-win for Trump and Abe.
That's Dr. Christine Dennehy, a professor of history and chair of the Department of History at California State University Fullerton. She was speaking with my colleague David Byrd. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis is making his way to attend the three-day annual Shangri-La Security Dialogue going on in Singapore. It begins today. This year's meeting of regional defense officials, an annual event since 2002, takes place days before that anticipated summit between the U.S. and North Korea, also comes amid tensions over China's maritime claims in the South China Sea. During a change of command ceremony at the Pacific Command headquarters in Hawaii, Mattis telegraphed some of the themes he's likely to reaffirm during the Shangri-La dialogue.
Our 2018 National Defense Strategy is the first of its kind in a decade, and it acknowledges the Pacific challenges and signals America's resolve and lasting commitment to the Indo-Pacific. Americans' vision is shared by most nations in the region, where every state's sovereignty is respected, no matter its size, and it's a region open to investment and free, fair, and reciprocal trade, not bound by any nation's predatory economics or threat of coercion. For the Indo-Pacific has many belts and many roads. America continues to invest vigorously in Indo-Pacific stability, bolstering the free and open rules-based international order that has enabled this region to grow and to thrive for over 70 years. While we are prepared to face any who would seek to challenge America's resolve, our national defense strategy is not a strategy of confrontation. Rather, it is a balance of idealism, pragmatism, and cooperation.
Secretary Mattis also announced that Pacific Command now will be called the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, reflecting what he called the increasing connectivity between the Indian and Pacific Oceans. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is slated to deliver the keynote speech during the Shangri-La dialogue. In his change of command remarks, Navy Admiral Philip Davidson warned that China continues to improve both the size as well as the capability of its armed forces in hopes of supplanting the U.S. as the security partner of choice and in its own terms, as a matter of fact. Ralph Kosa, president of the security think tank Pacific Forum, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the focus of Shangri-La will not be North Korea, but China.
I think Mattis will probably use this, as he has the last couple of years, to sort of lay down some markers on growing concern about China, as reflected particularly in the National Defense Strategy and the earlier National Security Strategy.
Not just China, but Russia as well.
I think the Russians get honorable mention. Certainly, if this were a European meeting, they would they'd be higher on the list. But somebody described them as a major power, but not a major player when it comes to Asia.
So China's growing assertiveness in the South China Sea, will that be agenda item number one?
I think it will be. Mattis normally gives a pretty nuanced presentation, and he talks first and foremost about American policy and American commitment to allies. But everyone will be waiting for the Chinese shoe to drop, and when it does, that'll be the headline.
This comes as two U.S. warships sailed close to the Paracel Islands, where China is pretty busy. China, of course, responding rather strongly against that. Mr. Mattis, on his way to Shangri-La, suggested this kind of freedom of navigation movement will continue.
I'm sure we'll hear the mantra. The U.S. will fly and sail anywhere that international law allows. That's been the stated policy for years and will continue to be the stated policy.
But that's still not going to stop China from doing what it's doing in South China Sea. What actually is it doing, do you think?
China is trying to create new facts on the ground, and they've done that. They've made it very clear they're not going to leave anytime soon. They keep talking about a code of conduct, but it's relatively meaningless since nobody has honored the declaration of conduct the parties in the South China Sea that they negotiated, 14, 15 years ago. They'll talk a good game while they'll continue to build up their facilities and militarize them while claiming they're not militarized.
India's Prime Minister Modi will be giving the keynote speech on Friday at the Shangri-La Conference. Is that significant?
Yeah, I think it is. You know, India has been a major player at Shangri-La for the last couple of years and is, you know, sent their defense minister, and having Modi there certainly underscores India's importance, and it sort of coincides with the new buzzword du jour, the Indo-Pacific. So, you know, I think that it helps to focus on the broader definition of the region, which now includes the Indian Ocean.
China's presence at Shangri-La will be a low-key presentation, or presence that is, by the Vice President of the Academy of Military Science of the Chinese People's Liberation Army, defense ministers and military leaders from more than 20 countries, including Germany, Indonesia, the Philippines, Russia, South Korea, the United Kingdom, and Vietnam are expected to take part. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. International Committee of the Red Cross is sending two surgical teams, other medical specialists, and urgently needed supplies, as well as equipment to meet the overwhelming medical needs in Gaza arising from the recent clashes between the Palestinians and Israeli forces. Lisa Schlein reporting now from ICRC headquarters in Geneva.
The International Committee of the Red Cross estimates more than 13,000 Palestinians have been wounded during violent protests since March 30th. The Red Cross says this number includes more than 3,600 people who were hit by live ammunition, resulting in nearly 5,400 limb injuries. ICRC spokeswoman Yolanda Jacquemet tells VOA, Red Cross surgeons are unable to treat all these people. She says their priority will be to help gunshot wounded victims.
We will open a 50-bed facility in Al-Shifa Hospital in a building that is currently unused. And we hope to be treating by the end of the year 600 to 700 serious cases. These represent hardly half of those in need of multiple surgeries.
She says the huge number of people needing medical care in Gaza would overwhelm health systems anywhere in the world, let alone in Gaza, which is under a permanent Israeli blockade and suffers from chronic shortages of drugs, equipment, and electricity.
What we have also seen during this emergency is that wounded people were pushed out of hospital in 24 hours because the beds were needed. What we have seen is that people suffering from chronic diseases such as high blood pressure, kidney problems, are also suffering because, again, the system is overwhelmed.
She says Gaza's health system cannot cope with its normal needs even in the best of times. Jacquemet says the Red Cross sees Gaza as a patient with a gaping, intercepted wound. She says the Band-Aid her agency is applying is clearly insufficient to heal this wound. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And now that the U.S. is withdrawn from the Iran nuclear agreement, what comes next? U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has outlined a plan, and on this week's edition of Plugged In, VOA contributor Greta Van Susteren interviews Brian Hook, a senior policy advisor at the State Department. VOA's Elizabeth Chernoff has more.
Nearly 3 weeks after President Donald Trump withdrew the United States from the Iran nuclear deal, there are signs of a new strategy from the administration. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who unveiled a 12-point framework for U.S. security with Iran, told VOA's Persian service the goal is to hold Iran's leaders accountable to its people.
So these 12 things that I listed are all pretty straightforward. We're not asking a lot from the Iranian leadership. Just behave like normal leaders. Don't loot your people. Don't waste your people's money on these adventures in Syria and in Yemen and in Lebanon and in Iraq. The list goes on. Lead your people. Build a great nation. Use the resources you have for that.
Targeting companies that do business with Iran is part of what officials hope will be a more permanent solution, senior State Department policy advisor Brian Hook told VOA contributor Greta Van Susteren.
Our goal is to have a treaty. And there's many different ways that you can capture a change in a bilateral relationship. We inherited a Iran nuclear deal that isn't even called an agreement. It's called a plan of action. It didn't even have signatures.
But some analysts say this new approach will be harder to accomplish without the support of European allies and partners in the region.
It is incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to achieve that in a single framework. And the Europeans have it right. They know that they can't do that. They are going to keep the nuclear deal and they build on it.
Others say appealing to the Iranian people, who took to the streets in anti-government protests earlier this year, is a crucial step in holding the country's leaders accountable. The Trump administration's latest sanctions are intended to target individuals and groups with ties to Iran's supreme leader. Elizabeth Chernoff, VOA News, Washington.
And still ahead, tariffs and the potential for a trade war.
The news never stops. So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Batty, host of your breakfast show, Daybreak Africa. As always, our newsroom is on top of the news of your interest. We provide you with up-to-the-minute news about Africa as well as world news. Tune in to our show right here on VOA Africa, your trusted source of news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. It's very good to have you with us today. There's more news. The United States escalating transatlantic and North American trade tensions, imposing 25% tariffs on steel imports and a 10% tariff on aluminum imports from the European Union, from Canada and Mexico beginning today. President Trump has repeatedly said such measures are necessary to protect American jobs and industries in key manufacturing sectors. Some American companies in Europe are not happy with Mr. Trump's tariff move. AP's Charles Delesma has the story.
U.S. businesses in Europe appear dismayed by the hit on steel and aluminum imports from the EU. They're worried it could spark a trade war. Susan Danger, who's CEO of the American Chamber of Commerce to the EU, says American businesses in Europe are very concerned by the damage a tit-for-tat dispute would cause to the transatlantic economy and its impact on jobs, investment and security across the Atlantic. Meanwhile, the European Union's top trade official says it's a bad day for world trade. Cecilia Malmström says the EU did everything to avoid this outcome. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Negative reaction from some of America's most important strategic allies has been quick and it's been fierce. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau called the tariffs, in his words, totally unacceptable and vowed retaliation.
We all know that this is going to lead to harm for American workers and American industries. Our economies are too interlinked to not have significant disruption in American families and American communities south of the border.
And U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross says the driving factor behind raising tariffs on steel and aluminum imports from Canada and Mexico is not the lack of progress in negotiations over the North American Free Trade Agreement.
Remember, this action is based on national security, and therefore, well, one has to consider the overall package that's on the table at a point in time.
Other negative reaction came from French President Emmanuel Macron, who was warning, in his words, economic nationalism leads to war. European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker says the U.S. move marks a bad day for world trade, announcing there is no choice but to proceed with the World Trade Organization dispute settlement case and additional duties on numerous U.S. imports. The retaliatory tariffs from the Europeans are expected to target several billion dollars worth of American goods, including such iconic American products as Harley-Davidson motorcycles and Levi jeans. Christine Lagarde, managing director of the International Monetary Fund, is warning a trade war will damage public trust in leaders. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
They call it Rainbow Mountain, or Mountain of Colors, where alpaca tour guides in Peru take a growing number of tourists to enjoy the spectacular scenery. Charging $3 a person, the community here rakes in $400,000 a year. Gambina Huaman is a tour guide of the Pampachuri community. We were dedicated to cattle breeding, he says, and agriculture and no option of attending school. But this work can change that and make things better. Striped lavender, gold, green, red, and turquoise adorn the landscape. 1,000 riders and backpackers hike it every day, but Huaman says the region does need infrastructure. We lack facilities for tourism, he says. For example, on the road, there are no vehicle parks and no lodgings. But environmentalists worry about destroying the landscape, and mining companies are also drawn to the mineral-rich land. For VOA's BizBee, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. A battle between two rap singers is nothing new, but a musical shoving match that's been going on for years has hit some new heights, as we hear now from Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald, who speaks with VOA's Jim Stevenson.
You used to call me on my cell phone, late night when you need my love. Call me on my cell phone.
You hear about rap battles all the time. Some rapper is always in conflict with another one. However, this week's big news story concerns a rap battle of unusual intensity between Drake and Pusha T. Now, it all started last week when Pusha T released his third solo album, Daytona. And one of the tracks, Infrared, accused Drake of using ghostwriters. And incidentally, this is a charge that others have raised against Drake in the past. Well, less than 24 hours later, Drake fired back with the song Duppy Freestyle, which targeted Pusha T along with his record label boss, Kanye West. This week is when things really started heating up. Pusha T responded with The Story of Adidon. The single's artwork features Drake in blackface makeup, while the lyrics accuse Drake of being a deadbeat dad. It alleges he has a secret son by a former adult film star.
Wow.
On May 30th, Drake issued a statement addressing not the lyrics of the song, but the blackface photo. He explained that the photo dated from 2007, when Drake was a young actor. He says he and a fellow actor were working on a project about African-American stereotyping and how hard it was to get good roles as a young African-American actor. The statement began, "I know everyone is enjoying the circus, but I wanted to clarify this image in question." So Drake is trying to put himself above the fray. Mm-hmm. But in reality, the circus has been going on for nearly two decades. Pusha T used to be in a duo, Clips. And Clips had gotten into a pay dispute around the year 2000 with a rapper named Birdman, who ran the Cash Money label. Cash Money was where Drake became a major rap attraction after Lil Wayne signed him to the label in 2009. So you had these two factions that have been firing back and forth for a long, long time. That wasn't the end of it. Thursday, Pusha T went on a Los Angeles radio station and said Drake's explanation with the blackface photo didn't change his mind at all. He accused Drake of being silent on all black issues, despite having the biggest platform possible. So Pusha T is out for blood. He's really going in on Drake. Mm-hmm. And as you can imagine, social media has been on fire with this conflict this week. And the consensus seems to be that Pusha T is landing more punches than Drake. Mm. So it's going to be interesting to see how Drake responds to this, because obviously Pusha T is far from done.
And as we know, social media can be quite a battleground.
It can indeed.
Maybe more so than the actual back and forth between these two.
Absolutely.
We'll see how it plays out, but we always like to see how the Top 20 Countdown plays out each and every week. Ray McDonald brings it to us on VOA 1, and you can also catch him on Facebook.
At VOA 1 The Hits.
Thanks so much, Ray.
You got it, Jim.
All the energy that you bring to me. My last girl would tear me apart, but she never wanna split a thing with me. But when it comes to you, you, I think I...
Well, it turns out that musical group Maroon 5 just released a feel-good tribute to several inspiring women across various industries. The music video, known as Girls Like You, features more than 20 celebrities, including Cardi B, who was featured on the song. The video comes not long after Drake released a similar star-studded video, Nice for What, that was in April. Among the women honored are Ali Raisman, Sarah Silverman, Tiffany Haddish, Ellen DeGeneres, that is, Jennifer Lopez, Chloe Kim, Mary J. Blige, and Danica Patrick. Quite a group, huh? Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Dave Magnus, I'm Steve Norman in Washington, hoping you have a super Friday.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $10 million for information leading to the identification or location of Muhammad al-Jolani, leader of the Al-Nusra Front, or ANF, terrorist group. This is the first Rewards for Justice reward offer for a leader of Al-Nusra Front, the Syrian branch of al-Qaeda. In 2013, al-Jolani pledged allegiance to al-Qaeda and its leader, Ayman al-Zawahiri, after he had a public falling out with ISIS. In 2016, in a video posted online, al-Jolani praised al-Qaeda and al-Zawahiri and claimed the ANF was changing its name to Jabhat Fath al-Sham. Under al-Jolani's leadership, ANF has carried out multiple terrorist attacks throughout Syria, often targeting civilians. In April 2015, ANF reportedly kidnapped and later released approximately 300 Kurdish civilians from a checkpoint in Syria. In June 2015, ANF claimed responsibility for the massacre of 20 residents in a Druze village in Idlib province, Syria. In January 2017, ANF merged with several other hardline opposition groups to form Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS. ANF remains al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria, and Jolani remains the leader of ANF, which is at the core of HTS. In 2014, ANF was designated as a foreign terrorist organization by the State Department. The same year, the UN added ANF to its sanctions list. Since its inception in 1984, the Rewards for Justice program has paid in excess of $125 million to more than 80 people who provided actionable information that helped bring terrorists to justice or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. For more information about al-Jolani, go to www.rewardsforjustice.net. We encourage anyone with information about al-Jolani to contact the Rewards for Justice office via email on the website, info@rewardsforjustice.net, by phone 1-800-877-3927 in North America, or by mail, Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520, 1-800-273-0303, USA. All information will be kept strictly confidential.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.